Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of March 16th, St. Paddy's Day weekend, 2012. Believe it or not, going to the gym could help with your finances.
People who start exercising also use their credit cards less. They tend to do their dishes earlier in the day.
We'll learn about the power of habit and how it can make us better savers. Most of us are habituated to cash, but what if you tried living without it?
I walk out of a hotel and the doorman grabs my luggage, throws it in the trunk of the taxi, and what am I going to do? I mean, I could ask him if he's on PayPal and PayPal him a few bucks, but it's a bit involved, and so I ended up stiffing one doorman.
The pros and cons of going cashless, and a visit with our resident limericist, Dr. Goose.
A limerick's hard to complete in the space of a typical tweet. Haiku, it is true, are simpler to do, but not a remarkable feat.
Your tax-themed limericks are coming up on Marketplace Money from 8 p.m. So you heard about this letter in the New York Times, right? An executive at Goldman Sachs resigned on the op-ed page and basically said, "Don't trust anyone on Wall Street." His name is Greg Smith, and basically he said Goldman had developed contempt for its clients, putting their needs last, and even going so far as to call those clients Muppets.
That was wonderful.
Bravo.
I loved that.
Oh, it was great.
Well, it was pretty good.
Well, it wasn't bad.
Well, there were parts of it that weren't very good, though.
It could have been a lot better.
I didn't really like it.
It was pretty terrible.
It was bad.
It was awful.
It was terrible.
Get him away.
Hey, boo.
Boo.
Boo! You know, perhaps you just shrug your shoulders and say, "Oh, what's new?" But our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore is here with some context. Hello, my dear.
Hi, Tess.
You know, I wanted to bring you on because I know you followed this all week. And to me, this was just the latest in a long line stretching back for years, if not decades, of reasons why we should be suspect of everything tied to Wall Street.
Yeah. You know, I mean, my interpretation of that letter, and people might take issue of this, is that if you dig into it, it's actually really a coming of age story, right? It's Greg Smith, who has been the good Goldman soldier for 12 years, who's done everything that's asked of him, you know, realizes that the system doesn't love him back. And he goes nuts, right? And he burns all his bridges. He resigns in public. But that's him realizing that not only can Goldman's clients allegedly not trust the system, according to his assertions, but he can't trust the system, right? So it kind of reveals this division on Wall Street where I guess I'll explain it this way. You know, there's an old joke, you know, what's the perfect amount of money to make on Wall Street?
I don't want to know.
$1 more than the guy next to you. There's something on Wall Street called the golden rule, right? He who has the gold makes the rules. And very often the guys who make the rules are aggressive. They can misuse that power. They're certainly not Boy Scouts. And if you work on Wall Street or if you work in a really aggressive industry, which a lot of people do, you take that for granted. But it doesn't mean that it's the way things should work. And in that sense, Greg Smith is part of this kind of larger voice of dissidents that we've heard of people who work on Wall Street who are saying, wait a minute, this isn't sustainable capitalism. I don't trust the system. I'm getting hurt by it. How can you trust it?
Well, then there's the question, because if we're talking about gold, you know, the people, the average investors who have their money in the stock market through a 401k or a 529 college plan, they certainly don't have any of the gold. So how can they trust that the guys who do give a hoot about them?
That's a really tough issue, but I would say try to find out as much as you can. Be educated. Now, will that stop you from getting cheated? Will that stop you from paying more fees? No, but at least you have a better sense of the game that you're playing and you can judge the risks that you're willing to take.
We have people writing to us saying, you know, oh, I hear that I should invest in gold. What do you think? Or, you know, can you tell me whether I should go into emerging markets? And my response to that is and always has been, if you don't know what you're talking about, then you shouldn't have any investment in that whatsoever.
Exactly. I have something called the mom bubble index. So my mom, when I hear from my mom about a sophisticated financial product, I know that it's a bubble. In 2007, she asked me what a CDO was. I thought she meant like a bank CD, and she meant CDO. Recently, she asked me about trading currencies, so I have my eye on currencies.
No.
But, you know, but it's that kind of thing. You know, you have to look past the hype.
Based on that A, you've got to do your homework. And then looking back at the last, say, 5 years, 10 years, and you have the dot-com bubble bursting, you have the housing bubble bursting, you have the financial crisis of 2008, followed shortly by Bernie Madoff, and now you have, you know, one of the executives at Goldman Sachs saying, I don't trust this place. Why should anyone put a dime in the stock market?
Good times, good times. That was a nostalgic trip that you just took me through. You know, that is a really good question. And again, it goes back to don't put anything in the stock market that you wouldn't be willing to lose. I mean, how can you rationalize it? I mean, one of the things that strikes me about this year, this election season, is that no one would dare to vote without reading newspapers and watching primaries and engaging with the political discourse. And yet they put their retirements and they put their money in banks without really being able to join the financial discourse. You know, you have to be as educated about those issues as you can be, because what we've seen is that when a financial crisis happens, it can just go from one asset class to another asset class. And who of us can truly be prepared? We all know we're going to lose money on something. Just let's try to make sure we don't lose all our money.
Thank you, Heidi.
Thank you.
And by the way, she wrote a fantastic blog post about all this, and you can find it at marketplace.org. You've no doubt noticed rising gas prices, and perhaps you've said to yourself, it has never been more expensive. I remember when gas was a dollar. Well, in real dollar terms, sure, but relative to what we spend on everything else? Well, you might want to check out a chart in this month's Atlantic Magazine, put together by Stephen Rose. He teaches at the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University, and he researched how our spending habits have changed over the last 60 years. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's start with some of the categories of spending that you looked at for this study. Give us a couple of highlights.
Well, if you look at food and clothing, and if you go all the way back to 1947, 42% of what we spent went to food and clothing in 1947. And today that number is down to 16%. So in other words, we freed up 26% of spending to get the same things. Not only do we have as much food as clothing as before, we spend on food on the more expensive way of eating our food. By 40% of our food budget is for eating out. When back then it was only about 15 to 20%. So this is what technological change does. It allows us to produce what we need, our necessities first, more cheaply, opening up the opportunity to increase spending on health care, for instance, which has certainly gone up a lot, education, recreation, and even business services.
That's so counterintuitive, though, because we, I think, assume that, you know, over time, pretty much everything goes up in price. And I mean, you're always hearing about how inflation has made everything so expensive. So is that a matter of we are making more and so less of our budget is going toward those, or are they actually less expensive?
We economists have a term for that. It's called money illusion.
Hmm.
That is, you know, the money as a unit of account and a unit of measurement can change, but what really matters is relative to how much you get paid. So when we say that food now has gone down tremendously as a share of our budget, that's in real terms. Hmm. We don't see it that way because we just kind of think about it when it was cheap and now it's somehow or other more expensive because of inflation.
Right.
I have a mother-in-law who's telling me all the time, she remembers what it cost in the 1950s to buy food, and it's just so much more. So how can you say it's less?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we make that much more.
But there again, you know, I think folks will hearken back to all the times where they've heard that our incomes actually have not gone up, that they have held steady, you know, at least over the last decade or so. But I guess we're talking about a longer time frame than that.
We certainly are. If you look at the longer time frame, like 15 years, our GDP per capita is up significantly. And, you know, if you go back much further, you know, if I tell you were to compare it to 1980, people wouldn't realize that our standard of living is about 50% more per capita than it was 30 years ago.
So what are we spending far more on than we used to? I know you've touched on healthcare already.
Well, healthcare is the big deal. Mm. I mean, and if you think about healthcare, it really went, let's say, from 5% of GDP in 1960 to 10% of GDP in 1980 to 15% of GDP in 2000.
And now it's 18 or 19%. There's no question it's going up to 20%. Probably no question it's going up to 25%. One in four of what we produce, probably in another 15 years, will be on health care.
Was there anything in here that surprised you?
Well, the size of the change. Food and clothing and housing used to be like 75% of what we spent our money on in 1900. And now today, they're about 26%.
Stephen Rose is a research professor at the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University. And you can find his article, How We Spend, in the April edition of The Atlantic magazine. Thanks so much for coming in. It's been fascinating.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace Money is supported by Farmers Insurance, which offers a directory to find a local trained agent at 1-800-FARMERS or farmers.com.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Check out the most recent pay scale index for the U.S., and you will see wages are on the rise again. Maybe you're even expecting a jump in your own paycheck. Wouldn't that be nice? But would that raise make you happier at work? Of course it would. Well, commentator Teresa Amabile isn't so sure.
A lot of research over the past few years shows that more money won't necessarily make you happier. And being happy at work can be more important than you think. No question, it's hard to find much joy at work if you're distracted by financial worries. But raises that push pay levels to $70,000 and beyond don't yield greater happiness. Why? Well, it turns out that most good events in life give us just a few hours or days of elation before we settle back to our baseline everyday selves. Don't believe me? Studies show that people may be drawn to a job by higher pay because they're unhappy with the work environment. There's only a weak link between pay and job satisfaction. In fact, the top half of wage earners are no more satisfied than the bottom half. My research found that professionals reflecting on their workdays almost never talked about pay, bonuses, or raises, but they had plenty to say about the things that affected their happiness. Relationships with colleagues, support from managers, and progress in work they cared about. But if you still think extra money is worth some suffering, consider the consequences. Your happiness at work affects your productivity and creativity. When you're happier, you're less likely to get sick. And I'm talking about everything from getting a cold to having a stroke. And at the end of the day, how happy you are at work carries over to how happy you are at home and in the rest of your life. So that raise surely would be nice. But if you think it will turn your work life rosy, think again.
Teresa Amabile is a professor at Harvard Business School and co-author of The Progress Principle. Maybe we'd all be happier if we didn't have any money, or at least no physical money.
And it would be a lot easier. We just wouldn't have to think about those crumpled up bills in our pocket or going to the ATM when it's inconvenient for us. And so I sort of do dream of the day when this is going to happen. I am looking forward to this.
We'll hear about one man's effort to go cashless. And you guys do not want to miss this week's Piggy Award winner on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and I'm joined yet again in the studio by our peerless senior producer, Patty Hirsch.
This yet again thing, Tess, that makes it sound a bit of a chore.
Well, you know, it's happening more often.
Well,
which means our mailbag is full.
Exactly. There's a reason, and the reason is because people are writing to us torrents of mail.
I love that.
A tsunami.
Oh. Well, at least it's not a tornado.
No, it's good stuff. It's all good. It's all good.
Well, what do we have? We've covered everything from fashion to pets to
most recently we covered wealth and poverty. And that got a lot of mail, actually. A couple of kind of central questions about this. Whitney Button wrote in from Los Angeles, just down the street, and she's asked, what is the upper class? Is it based on family income, net worth, financial independence, that is to say, not needing to work? She says she's heard many opinions on what qualifies a person or a family as upper class, and she would love for the Wealth and Poverty Desk to clarify this issue.
Stay tuned.
So one of the other issues that we got, that we had touched on, of course, was the pet coverage that we did almost a month ago now.
Yeah.
Yes. What sound does a lizard make? I don't know.
Oh, we neglected the lizards.
Yeah, we left the lizards out. I'm sorry about that. Lizard lovers.
The lizard 2%.
But so the mail that we got, a lot of mail about this, about our coverage of pets.
A lot of what we were doing was trying to take a look at how we make the spending decisions that we do around our cats and our dogs and our fish, and particularly when it comes to their health care.
Yeah, I mean, it's a huge amount of money. I mean, it's, you know, at one point we said in the show that it's the amount of money spent on pets during the year. Last year was more than spent on music and video games put together. And so it's we're talking about a serious amount of money here. So a lot of people were very interested in the way we covered this whole issue of end-of-life care for pets and the amount of money that people will spend to prolong a pet's life. And for many of the listeners who wrote in, they said that they really – they can't put a price on this. In fact, they find it very difficult to put a price on their pet's health at all. Gay Marks wrote in from Yarmouth, and she said, Yarmouth, Maine, that is, and she said she recently spent over $700 just to have a wart removed from her dog's nose. The biopsy was negative, but she asked herself, did we have a choice? Not at all. So I thought that was, it's really interesting that, you know, it's not just end-of-life care that people are concerned about when it comes to their pets. It's any kind of expenditure to make the pets comfortable.
Absolutely.
Finally, the other question that we got asked a lot about with regard to pets was pet insurance. You know, we made the point that only about 1% of people actually do have pet insurance in the US. And a couple of people wrote in about this. Kirk Ryan from Baton Rouge in Louisiana, he said that his point of view was only 1% of pet owners have pet insurance, largely because of ignorance and distrust.
And I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I think for a lot of years, in fact, even on this very show, we have discouraged people from getting pet insurance because for so long, so many things were not covered. Mm-hmm. You would have pet insurance and then your pet would get sick. And, well, that's not something that's covered under your policy. But it probably is time to take another look at that, see if it's any better than it used to be. Mm-hmm. So let's plan to do that in the coming weeks.
Absolutely. Music to JC Engel of Loveland, Colorado's ears. She said very specific, I would love to hear a good pro-con discussion about pet health insurance.
So all right.
We'll see what we can do for you.
Consider it done.
So getting away from pets now, another stream of correspondence that came in was in regard to a number of conversations that we had over the last couple of months about financial advisors. Mm. Several people wrote it and said they would love to know what the sort of the methodology for choosing
a
good
one.
Yeah. Personal, independent personal financial advisor. So I was racking my brain to think of somebody that we could speak to, someone who has experience as an independent personal finance advisor and could perhaps talk to us, you know, in a friendly way, somebody who we have a relationship with, someone who can communicate well.
I can think of at least one person.
Really?
Yeah. Aunt Jill.
Aunt Jill, yes. And you know what? The last time I introduced Aunt Jill, I kind of did this little sort of, it was a fanfare, but it was a really weak fanfare. So In order to introduce Jill this time, we've got a slightly different fanfare. Ladies and gentlemen, from CBS MoneyWatch.com, Jill Schlesinger.
Oh, thank you, my loyal subjects.
Wow, can you ask that little girl at the back to put your train down now?
Yes.
And the flower girls?
It's a wonderful honor to be introduced with such music.
Yeah, you're not Aunt Jill anymore, you're Queen Jill. you're going to need to remove the crown so you can put the headphones on.
There is a Mrs. Schlesinger, that would be my mother, is the queen. I'm just the princess.
Oh, well, princess.
I'm saying nothing. I've heard that before, but...
How's that glass slipper?
That's awesome.
What do you do with all those retainers?
Oh, come on now. Move on.
All right, well, let's get serious now.
Yeah, so right. can you help us out with this? I think listeners just do not even know where to begin. The question here is, who can you trust and how do you know?
It's a very tough one. And there are all different kinds of people who will give you financial advice. Mm. And the way that you can look at them is to really sort of say, well, how do they charge, right?
Right.
So three basic methods. One is that there is commission. So you go to a big brokerage house, a big wire house out there, and you know what they are, Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, and there's Merrill Lynch, and there's all these other ones. And they generally will charge a client based on a transaction. And so that commission base is accounts for about 80% of the people out there giving advice. So
they're 80%?
Yeah, it's amazing.
So commission based is number one. And you recommend Yes, no?
I generally don't recommend it. I mean, again, if you are somebody who is just needs a place to pop a bunch of holdings, then you could use an online account. You can use a lot of different places to just hold assets. You probably don't need a commission-based broker. But then again, you know, some people just want to have some place to call. And yeah, okay, then maybe. But it's a very small percentage of the population.
This issue of a conflict of interest, how do you know? Yeah. If there is one.
Mm. Well, can you ask some pointed questions?
Well, the number one question that you can really ask is, are you registered as an investment advisor? Ah, this is magic, because you've got to register with the SEC. And the SEC says now you have a fiduciary duty unto your client. That means you have to put the needs of your client before your own needs or your company's needs. Hmm. Now, there is another type of advisor that you can also talk to, and that's called a fee-based, or someone who charges you an hourly rate or a flat rate. Those people can be registered as investment advisors, but they're just going to give you the information you need. They're not necessarily going to do anything for you. They're going to give you the information. You go do it yourself. Hmm. How do you feel about that?
I feel good about that. I mean,
you do?
Yeah.
Well, you're a do-it-yourself kind of guy. Yeah, I'm lazy.
I'm the same way. I mean, I pretty much manage my own financial affairs, but if something specific were to come up, you know, I might want someone to just spend an hour looking at my finances and telling me a couple of recommendations. Mm.
You are exactly the kind of people who would have killed me when I was an investment advisor. Yeah. I could never make money from you. No, I'm just kidding.
Well, no, I mean, that's a really interesting point, because the advisor has got to make money somehow.
Exactly. And that's why there are very few hourly or fee-only financial advisors, because it's hard to make a living doing that.
Which is really interesting, because that's what we promote on the show constantly. But maybe there aren't that very many to find.
There aren't as many as you would think. And if you go to the National Association of Personal Financial Advisors, NAPFA.org, you're going to see that it's not as many people as you would think. Mm. The other thing I want to point out is there are a lot of people out there that really don't want to do it themselves. You know, there are people who say, this is just too much. I want to hire you to do it, but I want to make sure you're working in my best interest. Right. Now, if that's the kind of person you are, then you're going to talk to somebody who operates usually under what's called the asset under management model, or AUM. And what that means is that basically whatever your portfolio is, the advisor will charge a percentage of that and will usually proactively manage your portfolio. And you're usually handing over discretion to that advisor. Like, can you imagine? This is making tests completely break out in hives, I'm sure.
Yep.
You're signing over a document that says, we went through the portfolio. I'm a growth investor. You're going to invest it based on my goals and objectives. You're a fiduciary. Go at it. Go crazy. You know, I got $1 million. Here's 10 grand a year. Goodbye.
Yeah. Well, you know why that raises my hackles? Because I remember some guy named Bernie Madoff who did exactly that. Right?
Well, it's true, but you know,
I have a problem with anyone just handing over their money and saying, you take care of it.
Well, you know, I guess it depends. I think that there are certain things that you can ask and you can say, you know, basically you want to know who's clearing your trades, where is my money kept, do you have an interest in that company? Those are the kinds of things that you want to know. So if you said to an average guy who is an investment advisor, you know, Joe Schmo Inc., and he says, yes, well, I'm my own investment advisor, I'm independent, I am registered as a fiduciary, I hire Charles Schwab to hold your accounts, Charles Schwab clears your trades, everything you can get on this website and see everything that's done, there's sort of some checks and balances there. Alternatively, it's, you know, Mr. Madoff. It's Madoff says, I am your investment advisor. I have fiduciary responsibility. He was registered as an investment advisor, by the way. Mm-hmm. Right. I have my own broker dealer, so I make trades for you. And I have my own clearinghouse called Madoff Securities. That should raise some eyebrows. If somebody has like three of the three things that are sort of important, the three divisions here in the investment process, again, the advice giving, the trading, and the actual holding of the accounts. Those are the kind of people I like to avoid.
Interesting. So, I mean, this sounds, even for something as simple as this, it still sounds very complicated.
It does.
Jill, you've outlined a number of very salient questions that you can ask during the process of when you choose one of these people. And I think what we'll do is we'll post something on our website, things to watch out for, questions to ask whenever you're actually selecting one of these people.
All right. Thanks, Jill.
Great to be with you.
Thanks, Jill.
Take care. I love it.
Marketplace Money is supported by Delta Airlines, featuring flatbed seats with direct aisle access on select international routes. Tickets available at Delta.com. Delta, keep climbing. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Saving money, exercising, brushing your teeth, all very good habits to have. On the other hand, smoking, biting your nails, going on spending sprees, well, those are habits we would rather not have. But plenty of us do. Scientists have found 40% of our daily actions are habitual. And if you'd like less of the nail biting and more of the exercising, you can do it with a little brain work on your part. Charles Duhigg writes about this in his new book, The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business. Welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you don't promise a whole lot in this book, except that through better habits, we will lose weight, raise exceptional children, and build revolutionary companies.
Right, right. And you'll be better looking, too.
Exactly. One of the things that you talk about in the book that really was fascinating to me is that there is this research out there that shows that part of what habit is our brains looking for ways to save effort, and that the creation of habits is a way to actually save your head.
That's exactly right. And we've learned about this thing, the habit loop, that every habit has these three parts, a cue, a routine, and a reward. And what's really important is that exactly what you just said, that your brain kind of stops functioning as a habit unfolds, which means that we can have smaller brains and we have mental space to think about inventing fire or aircraft carriers or video games. But it also means that that's why these patterns feel so uncontrollable, is because you actually stop thinking when you're doing a habit.
So rote becomes what you want.
Exactly. In fact, a sense of craving, a neurological sense of craving, emerges that kind of ties together the cue and the reward. And once that craving is there, it's very difficult to overcome, although part of this research has told us is how to overcome it so that you're not quite the prisoner to all of your routines that you used to be.
Well, let's pick up on that, because what we really wanted to have you come on and talk about is how we can apply some of this science to our daily money habits. And you could even argue that spending is a habit with us, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think particularly when it comes to like credit cards, for instance, when I use cash, it's harder to spend than when I use a credit card.
Oh, yeah. It's a little more painful.
And something about that plastic, it's so easy to automatically pull it out and swipe it and get exactly what I want. The reward is right there sitting in front of me, right?
Right.
And a lot of shopping today is designed to take advantage of those habits.
How do we establish for ourselves some rewards for saving? Because the whole point is to put it away and not do anything with it.
That's exactly right. And in fact, this gets into what psychologists call the golden rule of habit change, which is you can't eradicate old habits. You have to change habits so that it's triggered by the same cue and it delivers the same reward. And just the routine, the behavior changes. There was a really interesting study that was done in Peru where they were looking at people who traditionally had terrible problems saving. And they created a new type of bank account for them where part of their paycheck would go into essentially this lockbox. They divided them into two groups. One group got access to a little bit every 2 weeks that they could use to splurge with. The other group didn't really get access to it every 2 weeks. They could just check on the balance. The group that would splurge saved much, much more, because there was something about anticipating being able to build up a little bit of savings and treat yourself to something nice every 2 weeks that made saving over a year or over 2 years or over 5 years much easier. And I think that's the lesson here, is that if you're saving, you need to give yourself some rewards ever so often. But the problem is that for most people, they never let themselves have that splurge.
Let's talk about the cue, because that is the first part of this process. When it comes to saving money, what kinds of cues could we potentially establish that might do the same things for our brains?
So all cues, according to studies, basically fall into one of five categories. It's either a particular place, a particular time of day, a certain emotion, the presence of certain other people, or a preceding action. So for your question, how do we create these saving habits? Which in some respects, there's probably two habits there, right? Well, part of it is putting aside money, saving it. And part of it is not spending, right? Changing a spending habit so that you don't buy stuff you don't actually need.
Right.
And I think the spending habit, it's really interesting to try and figure out what the cue is, because I think it differs across different types of spending. We know that some people spend more when they feel certain emotions, right? When they feel stressed out. Like, for instance, when I'm having a bad day, it's kind of nice to go buy something for myself.
Right, sure.
It makes you feel a little bit better. So the cue there is this certain emotion. And part of this is just figuring out what those cues are so that you can be on guard for them. There's this concept of keystone habits, that some habits matter more than others, and that if you change a keystone habit, it kind of causes this chain reaction in someone's life. One of the things that we've found, or that scientists have found, is that a number of keystone habits tend to have financial impacts. So, for instance, when people start exercising more, they also start eating better. But people who start exercising also use their credit cards less. They tend to do their dishes earlier in the day because exercise sets off this chain reaction. It tends to make other patterns more malleable in our life, particularly financial patterns. So one of the answers to savings
is to go to the gym.
Is go to the gym. Figure out what your keystone habits are, and your credit card will stay in your pocket, as if by magic.
The book is The Power of Habit, Why We Do What We Do in Life and Business, and the author is Charles Duhigg, and we've been talking about that book, and perhaps we'll have to make a habit of having you on the show.
I would love that.
Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And by the way, our conversation was so interesting that I kept Charles in the studio far longer than what you've just heard, so you can hear the full interview at marketplace.org. Taxes be funny? It is if you rhyme or are punny. So tune in for kicks as we recite tax limericks coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland. I don't know about you, but I always like to have a few dollars in my pocket and probably in my car, too. After all, you never know when you're going to need some cash, right? Well, what happens to that notion when we finally, inexorably, become a cashless society? Seth Stevenson is putting that question to the test. He's been living cash-free for about 2 months now as part of an experiment for Slate.com. We invited him to our studios and, well, we didn't charge a dime because we knew he wouldn't have one. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to talk to you because a few months ago we spoke with your Slate colleague Farhad Manju about cashless apps. And at the time, I experimented with a couple of them and, you know, it went okay, but to me, the big problem there was that not enough people are using them, right? So you can't really exchange a lot of money with a lot of people. Why did you decide to try to go cashless?
Well, this was a stunt that we at Slate cooked up, and we decided that we would look at this from all sorts of angles, you know, who gains and who loses as we move towards a cashless society. Mm-hmm. For instance, the machinist unions don't want us to get rid of coins, and they're the companies that make the paper we use to print dollar bills on, who obviously have a stake in that. And my role is to live cashlessly and see what that's like and where the speed bumps are. And for the most part, it's gone actually fairly smoothly. I mean, most places take credit cards. Taxis in New York take credit cards. And if you want to, you can avoid most of the situations where you need to have cash, but you do bump up against a few where there's just no getting around it.
What are some of the roadblocks that you've run up against?
So there is tipping. That has been a big problem. For instance, I walk out of a hotel and the doorman, before I can do anything about it, grabs my luggage, throws it in the trunk of the taxi. And what am I going to do? I mean, I could ask him if he's on PayPal and PayPal him a few bucks, but it's a bit involved. And so I ended up stiffing one doorman.
Oh.
Felt really bad about that. I'm working on a solution. I'm thinking a low denomination gift card to some national chain could be the way to go with that.
And just with like $1 or $2 on it?
Yeah, or, you know, $5 to Target, something like that. I haven't figured that out entirely. The one other place that I think there are speed bumps is in illicit activities, and that's because people don't want those traced. And so that's going to be the holdout. Drug deals, obviously, people selling drugs don't want to have a trace on their transaction. And I actually, as part of this Slate experiment last week...
Don't tell me you went out and bought drugs.
I did.
Oh, dear.
I bought $20 worth of marijuana with a $20 Target gift card. And the I did. And the guy who sold it to me, I asked him, you know, will you accept a $20 Target gift card for this gram of marijuana? And he sort of scratched his chin and said, well, I do live near the Target. And I do need some household wares. So, okay, fine. It's fine.
Do you think the reaction would have been the same if it was Bed Bath & Beyond?
Tough call. You have to know your demographic, right?
Well, so we've talked about a little bit of the downside. What was the upside for you so far?
The upside has been I never have to worry. Where is that ATM? You know, it's late at night and it's dark out. Where is the nearest ATM? I've got to find one, and then I never have that thing where I have all this change in my pocket and I don't know what to do with it. And at the end of the day, I have to put it on top of my dresser and it just collects there. I guess it's just. Here's the thing. If it's so close to being seamless, we're so close where if everyone just had these apps, if everyone had a smartphone, which we're not quite there yet, and
right.
everyone had these apps, we're so close to having it, and it would be a lot easier. We just wouldn't have to think about those crumpled up bills in our pocket or going to the ATM when it's inconvenient for us. And so I sort of do dream of the day when this is going to happen. I am looking forward to this.
You talk about how we're so close to this, but... we're really not, because as you said, not everybody has a smartphone. It's going to be a long time before everyone has a smartphone, is able to afford a smartphone. And even the people who do have smartphones don't necessarily have Square or the apps that they're going to use. And I think on top of that, people are still a little leery of this whole notion of a cashless society.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who really don't like the idea of having these gigantic corporations know everything they're doing
right.
and taking a little slice of it all the time, too. That's the other thing. With cash, you know, there it is. It's an exact amount. You know what you're doing with it. No one else knows what you're doing with it. No one's taking a piece of it when you hand it back and forth between your friends. And so people do resent having some mysterious, company out there in the ether, having a hand in all their transactions. And there will be holdouts for a while.
Seth Stevenson, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And our lawyers asked me to state the obvious that we do not endorse the illegal activity mentioned in our story. I would have thought this happened long ago, but apparently in 2008, the world experienced a significant shift. For the first time, most of us lived in cities rather than in the countryside. And that has all sorts of consequences. And one of them is a new strain on the healthcare system in rural communities. Reporter David Weinberg profiles one university's possible solution to a nationwide shortage of small-town doctors.
If you drive east out of Kansas City on I-70 through acres of green soybean and cornfields, you'll eventually come to Salina, Kansas, population 50,000. Kathy Haney grew up in rural Kansas.
As a high school student, I knew every doctor in town. I saw him on the street, I knew who he was, and two or three of them would have known my name. Today, I walk in over there, and there's not that many medical people.
Haney says one of the downfalls of having hardly any small-town doctors is that they have less time to spend with their patients.
There was a lot more personal interaction with the doctors. I don't feel like there's involved in the community.
I'm from Atchison, Kansas. It's about an hour north of Kansas City.
Jill Korbstein is one of 8 students in a new program created by Kansas University. It's located in Salina, Kansas, and has one main goal, to keep doctors in small towns. Jill knows what it's like to grow up without a doctor nearby.
I grew up on a farm, and my parents raised beef cattle. And we have corn and soybeans and cows and pigs. I did not go to a doctor very much growing up. And I know my dad does a lot of self-doctoring as well as other people. I can't say I remember my doctor growing up because I did not see him very much.
The Solana program encourages students to serve in rural communities after they graduate.
I feel like the program definitely promotes it, but they want us to be good doctors, number one, no matter where we end up. So they try and promote the rural area, but I'm going to go wherever I feel like I'm going to be the best at.
Dr. William Cathcart-Rake is the director of the Solana program.
We have 110 counties in Kansas. At least 85 of those counties are critically underserved.
The problem, Dr. Cathcart-Rake says, is that students from rural Kansas have to go to medical school in big cities.
We have problems with young physicians going to Kansas City with every intention of coming back to rural communities to practice.
But instead, they fall in love, they get married, and they start to put roots down in the city.
Hopefully, if we train them in smaller communities, they can meet the prospective spouses here, they can network here, and they have those connections, which hopefully can be lifelong.
When these students graduate, one of the biggest things that could lure them away from small towns is, of course, money.
Reimbursement rates for rural areas tends to be less than some of the reimbursement rates for big cities. Being a small town doc isn't always as financially rewarding as being a large town plastic surgeon or dermatologist.
The Solana program hopes to keep doctors away from big cities by offering financial incentives.
It's called KMS. It's the Medical Student Repayment Program.
Claire Hendrickson is one of the students in the program who signed on to the repayment program.
For every year that you take the program, you give back a year to a rural area, and they pay for your tuition.
The program gives Claire a living stipend, and for every year she works in an underserved county after she graduates, a year of her tuition is reimbursed.
But with that comes a tag, which means that if they don't practice primary care in an underserved area in Kansas, they have to pay that back with interest. So, you know, they've got those hooks in them.
Dr. Cathcart-Rake hopes students will consider the benefits of small town life when they ultimately decide where to practice.
We have a lot of salt of the earth people. Even if they can't pay, they're very concerned about how they can pay. And I had a patient come in yesterday and was so happy that she brought in a great big gift basket. Those are kind of things that happen all the time in smaller communities where they're your friends and you get to know them and you laugh with them and you cry with them.
It will be another 5 years before the first class graduates from the Solana program. For now, people in rural Kansas have to deal with long drives to doctor's offices. If the Solana program succeeds, it could be a model for keeping doctors in small towns across the country. In Solana, Kansas, I'm David Weinberg for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, committed to empowering professionals of the world with the knowledge needed to do what they do best, the knowledge effect.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. It's the time of the year that we dread. We'd rather lay all day in bed, but instead we labor for Uncle Sam's favor and pay taxes until we're dead. Okay, that's the extent of my efforts. Trust me, you all did a much better job than that in our latest Money Limerick Challenge in honor of St. Paddy's weekend. And because many of you are still working to get the IRS its pound of flesh, we asked for your tax limericks. And we've invited our good friend Dr. Goose, who has an economic limericks blog, to rejoin us. Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much, Tess. It's a pleasure.
This time around, of course, we have asked folks to talk to us about a subject near and dear to all of us, tax time. Do you have a limerick that you would like to share with us right off the top?
Sure.
All right, here we go.
A thrifty young fellow named Kevin, who was filing with Internal Revenue, when the bottom line showed all the money he owed, said, "It seems that I'm rich, and I never knew."
Oh, poor Kevin. So apparently he's got more money than he thought he had because the IRS has taken a bunch of it.
I have to say, Tess, that one was right out of my own experience, looking at that bottom line and saying, I really paid that much?
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get to some of our listener submissions that we've gotten over the last couple of weeks. And first up is a good friend of yours, Madeline Begun-Kane.
Ah, yes, Madeline.
Of Bayside, Queens. She's quite the limerick lady.
Mad Kane, as we affectionately call her.
All right. Well, she submitted this on our Facebook page, and it sounds like she would like to see some tax breaks for the middle class.
Dear folks at the Fed IRS, your rules and your regs are a mess. You're unfair to the poor middle class, even more. So beware, because I know your address.
Uh-oh. Do we want to be threatening the tax man?
Oh, my goodness.
Well, how about perhaps a couple of more? I know that you also looked at our Facebook page and had a couple of selections.
Yes, that's right. There was one by Robert Schechter that I particularly liked, and it cries out for a little dialect treatment, I think, in honor of St. Patrick's Day.
All right, here we go.
All right, I'll do my best. Though taxes upset and unnerve us and make us cry out, "Saints preserve us," they'd gall me much less if the damn IRS didn't claim to be doing a service.
Well done.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Well, we have another one from Andrew Neal of Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and also submitted this through Facebook.
While it's true that I don't have descendants and it's not covered in the amendments, I don't hire babysitters, but I buy lots of litter, so I'm claiming my cats as dependents.
That's an excellent idea.
Do you have another one that you'd like to share?
Sure. You know, around this time, I started thinking of taxation through the prism of people's political leanings. Mm. And it got me to thinking about conservatives and liberals and their view on taxing and spending. So here goes. A conservative, someone it peeves to pay taxes because he believes that they're soaking the rich for entitlements which he somehow forgets he receives.
All right.
A liberal is fiercely intent on the government's making a dent in the plight of the poor at the cost, she is sure, not of her, but the top 1%.
Indeed. All right. So we've got limericks on both sides of the aisle there. Well done. A couple of weeks ago on the show, I wondered aloud if anyone could actually come up with a tweeted limerick, 140 characters. And Jim Johnson was able to do this. He's from Muskegon, Michigan. He was able to do this by using numbers. Like for the word two, he used a two. For EZ, he used letter E-Z. So here is his Twitter-fied limerick.
To raise public funds, it is better. The IRS thinks to tax Twitter. Now a fee for each word is so truly absurd, but easy to charge for each letter.
Well done, I would say. Wouldn't you, Dr. Goose?
Very nice. And extra points for fitting it within 140 characters.
Yeah, I find that quite remarkable. Well, Dr. Goose, a.k.a. David Lefkowitz, thank you so much for coming in and a very happy St. Paddy's Day weekend to you.
A happy St. Paddy's Day to you, and it's been a true delight.
And now to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue plastic friend is headed to Granger, Indiana, thanks to a letter sent in by Mike Chappell. I'd like to nominate my son, Richard, he wrote. Oh, we have Richard on the line to find out why. Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, how are you?
Good. Why don't you tell me a little bit about yourself?
I'm 10 years old and I live in Granger, Indiana. I like to look into the Marketplace Money with my dad.
And why do you like the show?
I like listening to all the different people with their saving money.
And tell us about your habits with money.
I don't spend money on something when I want to buy something. I save up on it and do jobs to get things.
Can you give us an example of when you've done that?
I wanted a basketball hoop one summer because yours broke, and my dad said I could buy one if I wanted, and I said I wanted to save up for it, so I asked him if there was any jobs I could do, so I mowed the lawn every week for a whole summer, and now I got a basketball hoop.
How much did that cost you?
$250.
Wow, well, good for you. So how much do you have in the bank now?
I have $500.
You still have $500 in the bank?
Yes.
That's amazing. Tell us why you decided that savings was important for you.
Because if I spent all my money on one thing, that I wouldn't have enough money to get anything else I wanted to spend on.
That's right. Well, I love that you're a good saver, and especially at your age, that's absolutely wonderful. And we'd like to give you a Marketplace Money piggy bank for that.
Thanks.
Well, congratulations, and thanks for talking to us. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And one more thing before we leave young Mr. Chapel. His dad wrote to us after a long car ride during which the family, mom, dad, Richard, and two other sons listened to our podcast. My wife and I, he writes, had to endure the three of them singing the Piggy theme song for 15 minutes. How can we resist that? Boys, take it away.
Na 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 na.
Oi,
na 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 na.
Oi,
oi.
Na 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 na.
Oi, oi.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Be sure to friend us on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, as manufacturing jobs disappear, blue-collar workers are remaking themselves.
Before working at Ford, my position a lot of times was the same thing every day. Now coming into nursing, I don't know what to expect.
I could be a truck driver. I'm looking at all these manual labor positions. Then I said, wait a minute, I'm getting kind of older to be doing manual labor. So I just put my name on a piece of paper and said, I want to be a nurse.
I worked on cars for this long. Now I'm going to work on people for a while. And people thought I'd make a good nurse.
An hour-long special we're calling The Comeback Chronicles, our latest collaboration with the New York Times. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Sasha Woodruff, and Sonata Lee Narcisse. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yor. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by the American Institute of CPAs' new Chartered Global Management Accountant designation, CGMA. Established with the Chartered Institute of Management Accountants to recognize professional accountants helping business succeed. CGMA.org.
This is APM.